Okay, this is Kurt Asher, and I'm interviewing Jim Shaw in his office at 3223 Sillick Avenue in Bakersfield at 9:30 a.m. on Thursday, December 4th, 2014. Jim, could you state and spell your name, please?
Jim Shaw, J-I-M-S-H-A-W.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in September, on September 29, 1946 in Estherville, Iowa.
Estherville, Iowa. And could you tell me about your early life growing up, about your family and where you lived and moving and how you came to California?
Yeah, I have vague memories of Estherville, Iowa, a little 6,000 population town in Iowa. And we moved out when I was about 6 years old to Seaside, outside of Monterey. Mm-hmm. My dad was a builder and got tired of the cold, snowy winters there and decided to go to sunny California and a land of milk and honey. And after just 1 year in on the coast up there, Seaside, we moved to Fresno, California. And so that's where I grew up. I went to school I was in Fresno, California until I went to work for Buck Owens.
Oh, I see. Okay. Did you have a big family?
Just one brother and one sister.
One brother and one sister. Mm-hmm. How did you learn to play the keyboard, and do you play other instruments as well?
It's my main instrument. I got interested. I took piano lessons, I think, starting at the age of seven. My mom and dad rented a little waltz or spin it, and all of us took lessons. And I got tired of it. What it was I had a teacher who was teaching me how to read music, and every lesson she played a little song. This is a song you're going to learn this week. And I had a very good ear. Mm-hmm. So I would listen to what she played. And then when she left, I would just use my ear to remember what she played, and I'd play the song. And I got better and better at that as the songs got more and more complicated. I got better and better at that. And almost a year went by, and I never learned how to read music. And she didn't catch on until one day when I made some little mistake, played it slightly different. She said, "Oh no, you were supposed to be playing this note." And she pointed to a note on the paper. And I said, like, "What do you mean?" And I stalled around, and she said, let's just try a different piece of music. She pulled out a piece of music she hadn't played for me. She says, "Go ahead and play this one." And I couldn't, and I was busted. And she said, "Have you been just doing this by ear all this time?" And I said, "Well, I guess I have." And she said, "Well, we're going to have to start all over then." And then I was angry. It was no fun. I didn't want to start off with the baby stuff. I could play better than that. And I told my mom and dad I wanted to quit. I didn't like piano lessons. So, flash forward when I was 14, 15 years old, and I decided I wanted to play in a rock and roll band. And I started doing it on my own.
I see. But did you ever learn to read music, or?
Never did.
Really?
And that's really sad. I really wish I had.
Well, a number of the musicians I've talked to around here don't know how. It's a gift, I guess.
Right? I love jazz, and I've started trying to play jazz in the last 4 or 5 years, which is quite the stretch for country. And I know I should just take 6 months a year and just stop and learn how to do it, and I'm still stubborn. The age of 68.
So, do you play other instruments as well, or?
I play bass. Actually, I played bass in the rock and roll band before for a while, and picked that up by ear. And then when I was in college, I decided that playing 6 nights a week in the clubs would be, a great way to put myself through school. And a friend of mine pointed out that there's not a lot of places to do that in clubs in rock and roll, but there were a lot of places in Fresno, 7 or 8 nightclubs that had country music 6 days a week. And I said, "I know nothing of country, but that sounds interesting." So when I started exploring country music, I realized there were lots of bass players. They usually were good, the singers in the group, and there were very few piano players, so I dug up a version of Last Date by Floyd Kramer, which was a huge hit record at about that time, country instrumental, and sat down and learned how to play it by ear and then broke the various components out and kind of used that for my little toolbox of licks. And very limited, but I found a band playing on country music on weekends in Lemoore that was so desperate to hire me as a piano player. And I caught on pretty quick, and within a couple of little band changes, within about a year and a half or so, I was working with one of the, probably the better known Fresno nightclub country singers.
What was the name of that? I love
it. Yeah, it was the Tommy Force Band.
Uh-huh.
And interesting history, earlier on it had been Tommy and Ted Force, the Force brothers, and they just did not get along. They fought constantly from everybody I've ever worked with them both, and they were just oil and water. And Ted moved to Bakersfield, and Tommy stayed in Fresno. The Ted Force band played in Bakersfield many, many years. Later on at the Blackboard, after Buck was there, Ted Force was a big name, and I was with his brother Tommy in Fresno, paying my dues, learning my chops, learning how to play. He was a singer who insisted on playing in the perfect key for his voice. So if the song came out in the key of D, and he said, "This is a little too high to me," he wanted to play it in C sharp, D flat. That's the key we were going to put in. And as a piano player, it was, whoa, you know, that's difficult. But it was terrific training for me because I learned to play in all keys. And he made me do that. And so later on in my professional career, I was glad to have had all those 4 or 5 hours a night, 6 nights a week, doing all the old standards, learning that stuff.
So you played with the Tommy Force band, did you play with another band before Buck? Or?
Yes, the last year or so after I left Tommy Force, I started my own band, and it was called the Country Revolution. I didn't use my name in it, I wasn't the lead singer, I just played piano around the side, nobody knew it was my band, but I hired 4 other people, and we had our own TV show there on Channel 24 in Fresno, and played 7 nights a week there, I think, and after hours on the weekends until 5:36 in the morning. And I was making a ton of money being the band leader and doing all that work, and I was going to Fresno State College at that time to become an industrial engineer. I had got up to, I think, 98 units by the time I dropped out. But when I was going to graduate and become an engineer, at very best case, I was going to make it $8,000-$10,000 a year. And at that time, I was doing about $450-$500 a week in 1969. And I was like, hey, this is pretty cool. But in the back of my mind, I was a very practical person. I knew that I'd stumbled into something that was good. I always thought music, being a musician, especially live musician in the clubs, stuff like that, was like gunfighters.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a young gunfighter coming along to prove and knock off the old guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the strange thing is, in music, the old guy's 40 years old.
Right.
He's not truly old, but you know the people go out in the cars, they like the young, the young up and comers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just realized that was no way to have a career. I might be making good money now, but I better, be smart with it and have something a little bit better to fall back on. And so I needed to get that college degree and have that degree. And also, I wasn't the greatest musician in the world. I was I was really good at playing the right thing at the right time, which musicians call being commercial. Trying to play what the song requires, what the singer requires. And musicians joke about the kind of guy that, you know, plays everything he knows on every song. Mm-hmm. He knows all those wonderful things, and dang if he's not going to play them. Mm-hmm. So I used to joke, well, I am playing everything I know on every song. I just don't know very much. But I really tried to play, you know, make it sound like the record. And so I was a straight-ahead, decent musician, but I knew I was never going to stand out and be a star. So I had to get my college degree and plug away at that. And meanwhile, if I can put a bunch of money in the bank and in this band, that would be awesome. So that's what I was doing coming up on the end of 1969.
So did you finish? Did you get your degree?
No, I didn't. A huge big thing happened in October of 69 in Fresno. A guy named Doyle Kurtzinger, who played with Ronnie Pearson and the Rondons, got an opportunity to go to work with Buck Owens and the Buckaroos. And Buck was a huge star.
How did he get the opportunity, do you know?
That band, the Rondons, played the Vegas circuit for the decade before that. They played Reno, Winnemucca, Vegas, Nevada circuit, I should say. And they were the guys that played those in the lounges, and they would rotate bands all night, 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And early on in those days, one of the bands alternating with them often was Buck Owens in his early days. So he knew those guys, and he knew Doyle, liked his playing. And later on, when he needed a bass player, it came to mind, and he got in touch with him and hired him. So everybody was talking about that. And
did you know him from Fresno?
I knew him from playing out there at the nightclub called The Place.
Mm-hmm. And that was
the Ryan Pearson out on White's Bridge Road in Fresno. And Ron Pearson and the Rondons, and Doyle had been with him for 10, 11 years. Doyle left in October, and I took the opportunity to hire when their band broke up at that point. That was the end of the Rondons. And I hired their guitar player, who was the Don of the group, Don Lee, and of the Rondons, and put him in my band. And so meanwhile, Doyle was heading out on the road with Buck Owens, who was a big star at that time, and it was a really cool deal. And every now and then he'd come back to town to visit, and a couple times I ran into him, and he told me about this terrific recording studio that Buck had built, world-class recording studio, state-of-the-art in Bakersfield. And that's the studio that's out on at 1225 North Chester. And he had taken the old World War Movie Theater and gutted it out and put, at the time he started the construction of it as a sidebar, it was an 8-track recording studio. During that period of construction, they came up with the 16-track, and the board was modified and patched up and modified to become 16-track, and they had an 8 and a 16-track recorder.
I don't know what that means exactly.
A multi-track recorder uses a big, fat, wide piece of tape instead of a stereo tape that had two tracks on it for left and right. This one had 8 tracks or 16 tracks or later 24 tracks, where you could record the kick drum on one track, the snare on another, the bass, an acoustic guitar, another acoustic guitar, and you could add stuff later. And that's multi-track recording, which came along in the late 60s. Turned the recording industry on its ear, in a way. Okay. Another subject. But I heard about that studio and I thought, well, greedy capitalist that I was, I need to record our own album, LP, vinyl. That's what you put out in those days, at the studio there, and sell that at the nightclub and use the TV show to sell it, and I could sell a bunch of albums maybe. Mm-hmm. So that was it. So I asked Bill, I said, next time we're going, he was going back and forth to record on a regular basis because Buck did a lot of recording. He had to record all of his projects, all of the people that he signed with it, and Buddy Allen, Susan Ray, all these other acts, the Hagers, and he had to do, all these people had to do maybe two or three albums a year, plus a lot of other stuff. So I asked Bill, can I ride along with you and meet the engineer and see this place and get the brochures and the prices and everything? And he said, well, I'm not allowed to bring visitors to the... I said, well, I understand that. I said, they don't even have to know that we came along. I said, I'll just come in like I came off the street, and when we're all done, we'll ride back together. And he said, okay, sounds good. So this would have been March 7th or March 8th, I believe. And the reason I know is I found the old track assignment sheet and the reel of tape on the session that Buck was recording that day. So we got there, and this is a story I've told many times, and Buck told the story too. It's in his book, but he wanted a piano player for his sessions. The Buckaroos did not ever have a piano in them. They were just guitars and Don on the fiddle and steel, but they would record, they'd put a piano on in the studio, but not traveling. And he had always recorded in Los Angeles and had a few people to choose from, but he was looking for a Bakersfield or somebody nearby that could do all of his recording sessions on piano. Someone told him that a good rhythm piano player is a guy named David Frizzell, who was Lefty Frizzell's brother. Mm-hmm. And David was a talented singer and guitar player and did know a little piano.
Was he living here?
Enough to get by. I believe at the time he was, but that is a good question. I don't know if he came up from L.A. or somewhere else or not. But Buck had hired him to see, if he'd be willing to be that guy. And unfortunately, the very first song on the very first session that day was a song called New Orleans, Cajun Queens, Mississippi Riverboats. It was a real tricky little song. Had strange chords in it, kind of a little cycle of chords. Da, 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 da. Weird, weird song. And then right in the middle of the song, it modulated to a very ugly key and continued on doing the same thing again. And David Frizzell was lost, as he should have been. Mm-hmm. It was a tricky song. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying to record this, and they have to keep stopping in the middle because mm-hmm. David can't play the chords, and his Buck's getting madder and madder and more and more frustrated. And finally, he says, let's take a break, and Doyle goes over to him, and he says, there's a piano player from Fresno out front. And Buck says, there he is. Really? He says, yeah, he's a regular piano player. So I hear all this later, mm-hmm. after the fact. I'm sitting out front. I've got my brochures in hand, and I'm killing time because I've got to wait a few hours. Sitting at the secretary, and all of a sudden the door bangs open, and this is out in the reception room in front, and I turn around to see this big star, Buck Owens, mm-hmm. burst into the room, looking 8 feet tall to me at the time, and I'm like, whoa, whoa. And he said, you're a piano player? And I said, yes. Yeah. And he said, can you play that song? And I don't know why he thought I would know. Maybe he thought that the doors were open. I don't know what he thought. Mm. But that's what he happened to blurt out. And like something would happen in a B-movie, when the standby, there's a name for that in the plays. I don't know what the standby is called. But
understudy.
Gets the big opportunity. And he's all I could think of to say was, yes. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, come with me. So we go, these two rooms, we go from the front room into this little other room where the stair goes upstairs in different directions, and then in into the control room and out into the studio. And there's a bunch of people just sitting around. I don't know who any of them were, but it was the Buckaroos, Don Rich, Doyle, Joe Wiggins, and drums. And a very uncomfortable, miserable-looking David Frizzell. Just, they're all just standing around there. So he said, what's your name? I'm Jim Shaw. And I get introduced. He said, Dave, he says, we're just going to try something else here for a minute. Dave, oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. So he says, you know, you want to run this down? And I still didn't know what he was talking about. I never heard the song. I said, yes. And so I'm thinking, okay, here we go. Okay, it's in the key of F. And I'm thinking, yikes, okay. You know, it's a cycle of four. I'm trying to figure this thing out. It comes to the middle, and they modulate. And, oh, man. So I'm trying to keep it straight in my brain. He says, are we ready to do one? And I'm thinking, holy cow. And I said, yeah, okay. And I don't know how, but I got through that without making a mistake. Just playing rhythm. Just jump, and just doing what needed to be done. And so it's we get done, and every night, nice job. And he says, can you hang around and do the rest of the session? And over behind him, I see Doyle in the bass, and there's a stool over there behind his little divider, looking at me with these big eyes, kind of like, don't tell him you're with me. He's afraid I'm going to get him in trouble, which is silly. But anyway, he's thinking I'm going to say, well, yeah, I have to stay because I drove down with Doyle, and then Doyle's afraid he's going to get in trouble for bringing a visitor. Uh-huh. So anyway, I just said, no, sure, I'd be happy to stay. And he said to Dave, you know, Dave, sorry it didn't work out. I'll be happy to pay you for the session. And Dave said, oh, you don't have to do that. Oh, yeah, I ought to do that. So anyway, we did a couple, two, three more songs, which were much simpler. Mm-hmm. And then he said, would you like to be doing sessions down here? And I said, absolutely. I told him what I did and where I played. And so that would have been March. I remember we only did just, we were done, I was coming down three days a week sometimes, 4 days a week. But just after two or three sessions, all of a sudden, for 3 weeks, there weren't any because they went to Europe. They went on a European tour at the end of March. And then everything fired back up again, and I remember Don Rich saying, oh, I had to go to Europe, and he acted like he was burping. Mm-hmm. He didn't like going there. And but anyway, so April, May, and end of May, one day in my apartment in Fresno, I got a phone call, and it was always the secretary, the secretary for the recording studio calling saying, are you available to do a session Tuesday morning, da-da-da-da-da, and I'd say, sure, yeah, but this one isn't coming back for Buck, please, and it was Buck, so that was kind of okay. I knew how to talk to Buck. I'd go to the session, he'd come into the room, we'd do a business, he'd walk out of the room, and it's not like I had a warm and fuzzy relationship with him at all. Not a lot of conversation. So he said, are you able to come on down tomorrow at about 10 o'clock? Can you be able to come on down? And I said, yeah, sure. He said, yeah, let's just chat. So I remember I wore my suit. It seemed auspicious. I don't know what was going on. And ironically, at the time, that was probably kind of a weird, strange thing to do because there was not a suit to be seen around there. Mm-hmm. But flash forward a decade or two, Buck was always into the guys around him wearing suits. Mm-hmm. He said, you need to look like money. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was part of his business thing, and the way that you were in suits and ties, as I am today. So that might have figured in on things. But anyway, I showed up, and he and Don Rich was the leader of the Buckaroos, of course. We went into the control room, sat in the chairs behind the recording console, and he got right to the point and said, I was wondering if you'd like to join the Buckaroos. And I kind of wondered if that's what it was going to be, but it was still, wow. Yeah. And then they laid out the deal, the contract, the the money, what it entailed. I got a big salary that included going to up to a, he could use me 150 days a year on the road. That would be included. And I would go back twice a year and we would record the ranch shows in Oklahoma City. I would get paid extra for Yeehaw shows directly from them. I'd get all the recording sessions extra. I'd get residuals on this. I would get the album stuff, per diem, profit sharing, health insurance, yada, yada, yada. And they just did this all. So my brain, I'm kind of computing it out. And he said, and of course you'd have to move here, and I'm thinking, I'm going to have to drop out of college.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, I never wanted to be the flaky musician, and this thing's only going to last, you know, who knows how many years, and then who am I going to be? And so anyway, he ended up his spiel, after asking for any questions, which I had a few, with something that he said after every interview. I didn't know that at the time, it was my first, but over the decades I sat in on many of these, and he always said the same thing. He said, I don't want you to decide right now. I want you to think about this, and I want you to call me back and let me know. Mm-hmm. And what I found out through the years is what I'm supposed to say is, well, I don't need to think about this.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. But I said, yeah, okay, I like to think it over. I don't know if it's my imagination, if they kind of looked at each other. But anyway, I went home. I've always been a real practical, boring, conservative person. And I got out the legal pad and drew the line down the middle of the page and put pro and con on there and wrote it all down. And I thought, holy cow, this is a big decision. I had, I think, like I said, 96, 98 units towards engineering. I was going to take a pay cut. Not a huge pay cut, but a bit of a pay cut. I just started writing stuff down. And then I got down to one thing that popped into my mind. And it was going to be an exciting thing. I mean, I knew that the first week I joined, I was going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I wrote down on the bottom of the list, on the pro sides, if I don't do this, will I kick myself the rest of my life? Mm-hmm. And I stared at that. And I thought, oh, crap. I got to do it.
Right.
I got to do it. So I took the job and just jumped into it. It was my mind. I had fun. I had to tell the guys in my own band, you know, they got someone to take my place, and it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. So you answered a lot of my questions.
Good.
Yeah. When you came to Bakersfield, it was like, 1971?
No, it was 70.
70.
I had to move in June.
You moved here, yeah. Can you describe it? I mean, from a musician's perspective, what was it like in Bakersfield by then? Was there still a big music scene here? And
well,
do you remember the clubs and things?
Now, you have to understand that I moved into an apartment, the village apartments off Chester and 2nd, there for a while. Before I got another permanent place, I bought my own. Mm-hmm. But we basically went on the road quite a bit, and then when I was home, we were in the recording studio. I don't think I ever went out to a nightclub.
Is that right?
I don't think I ever did. I certainly didn't go out to the. No, I don't think so. I was aware of. I remember I saw Mark Leary for the first time. He was 15, 16 years old and just went on the Jimmy Thomason TV show. So I guess I watched that TV show at 5 o'clock and we were aware of a few musicians. Buddy Allen, and I went out to Merle's house and I met the Strangers through playing together various things and a lot of things. the local scene really, I'm ashamed and sad to say, I just never connected with it or knew about it, just mm-hmm. because we weren't in the same circles.
I see. So the circle that you were in was more of a national or LA-based?
Yeah, I spent, I went twice a year, and at that time spent 5-6 weeks at a time in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing recording sessions for a lot of people, and it was more of a national level, and when I was home, I didn't feel like going to, I hung around and read and did my own projects and didn't connect. Local people would come in and bands and record at the studio, and later on when I became I started wearing a lot of different hats later, and that comes later, but in, you know, I met them maybe through recording sessions and things, some of the local people.
I see. Okay. How did you, I guess you've sort of described how you got interested in performing country music. You were initially mm-hmm. in a rock band, and then...
I did it for the money. Yeah, I mean, just for the opportunity to play 6 nights a week, mm-hmm. 5 hours a night, and make, at that time, it started, it was 20 bucks a night. I mean, again, when minimum wage is $1.25 or right. whatever, I mean, 20 bucks a night was a pretty big deal.
Did you like country music?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't really, it's not like I said, oh, gee, I had to play country music. I really didn't know what it was, and then I was surprised to find a bunch of songs that were on the pop charts had been country songs. You know, You Are My Special Angel was as twangy as they get,
mm-hmm.
But it was a pop hit. The Tiger by the Tail was a pop hit, and you heard a lot of country songs in Pop Radio, and I had no problem with it. I love the Buck Owens stuff, and really got into it.
In the early years, most of the musicians that played country music around here lived in Bakersfield. But that had changed by the time you, many of them were living in different areas.
The Nashville ones? I mean, the national ones?
Well, I guess Buck was a national figure.
Well,
but there must have been...
Well, the only one that comes to mind is Merle when he moved up Northern California. But, you know, for a few years there, he was out there down at the mouth of the Kern River there in that big house. But, you know, a lot of those early people before my time, but, you know, the... Dallas Frazier and Jeanie Shepherd and they lived, sometimes they lived out, or you know, maybe in Shafter or Delano or Visalia, or not necessarily in Bakersfield, but of course Bill Woods and all those guys lived here in town.
Okay. Do you think that having a lot of migrants from Oklahoma and the Southwest and the Plains helped build the music scene here?
Oh, absolutely, and tons have been written on that, you know, by, you know, Buck and Merle and Bob Price, people like that, mm-hmm. and Gerald Hasn't. But yeah, it was a hotbed. It was interesting that enough, I don't know if it's been addressed, but there were probably other cities. I mean, there had to be a lot of this going on in Fresno, too, I'm thinking. Why Bakersfield? I don't know, but it seemed to be the epicenter.
And do you think that the reason it was the epicenter might have been because of Buck being here?
So well, when people talk about the Bakersfield sound, up until Buck, there had been some success, but if you think about it, all over the country, all over the United States, There are little towns and people that have a certain amount of success, you know, in that small, you know, the big fish in the small pond, and that might have had a hit and a couple hit records, and you know, whether it's Fair and Young or Hank Williams or something like that, and some of the places they come from, and that's what Bakersfield was before. I mean, you had. Maddox Brothers and Rose kind of playing in the area. You had certain people from the area, but nobody was paying attention to Bakersfield until Buck Owens popped out and just went huge. I mean, we're talking about some, you know, consecutive number one records, And this was before Mulhaven, by a few years, several years. And the fact that Buck did it the way he did with Donner at Capitol, with the producer Kim Nelson, thought, hey, you know, he was smart enough to say, I got a sharp guy who writes his own songs, has a good, hot little band, and if I just stay out of this guy's way, he makes good records. Normally, that wouldn't happen. You just basically, you bring in the musician, the studio guys, you tell them what to do, and you blend them into a big blender of, here's how we make music, and you give them your sound. And Buck just hit the jackpot with his system for Capitol Records and Ken Nelson. They used to say Capitol was built on the three B's, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, and Buck. And Buck's success was the reason Merle Haggard, when Ken Nelson found out about Merle Haggard, the door was open for Merle. Hey, I got to know these guys. Got a great band, writes great songs, great singer. I'm going to let Merle Haggard have his way. And sure, Buck's success helped that. Merle would have made it anyway. There's no doubt about it. He's the best, but the door was open for him. And those two guys, I mean, if they hadn't have happened, I'm sorry, I don't want to denigrate everybody else that happened in this town, but it wasn't going to be a famous thing.
So what is it exactly?
Let's compare it to the Austin sound, you know, that came out of Urban Cowboy and the Outlaw thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you take Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson out of there, I mean, come on. Yeah, Dallas Fraser, and there's terrific talent there, mm-hmm. awesome, terrific talent. Right. But it wouldn't have happened. So going back to your question, what is it that made it different? What made it different is it was these two guys using their own bands. It was fresh. And I think it was fresh in the way of the Beatles coming in when pop music was often overproduced and lost and bland and unexciting and interrupt. And when you have a four-piece group of, like, the Beatles, you just got four instruments, and they're sharp and edgy, and every instrument is playing the right thing, and there's space there. You can hear the instruments. You can hear the space between the notes and between the instruments, and everything is just right. And the Beatles weren't the best musicians in the world. I mean, Ringo was a stylist as a drummer. Think about it. Somebody could say, oh, you could have got a better drummer. You could have got so-and-so, the session drummer, who's, you know, and a bass player. You could have a bass player. You could have got this so-and-so. He's one of the top bass players in the world. And the guitar player, George Harrison, is good, but you could have got Eric, you know. Then it wouldn't have been the Beatles.
Right.
Those four guys went together, and this sound popped out, and it's exactly like, to me, what happened with the Buckaroos. That sparse, edgy, frantic sound, Buck being a huge fan of AM radio, realizing that I want to go into that edgy, sharp sound that just pops out of the radio. He was very astute with his sound. He didn't smooth it out. And everybody thought it was almost rock and roll at the time. And a Bakersfield record would come on the air, and two beats, just the ramp, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I mean, I could hear, it's like, oh, that's Bakersfield. Totally different sound, jangly and edgy and exciting. And later on, the Merle songs, same thing, the color, the sonic palette and the sound of that thing was just totally unique for Nashville, which is the best country musicians in the world, but they'd all got stuck in that big blender. It still goes on. You know, somebody comes up with a great idea and every studio in town is in it the following afternoon. And that the Bakersfield sound, I think, was Buck Owens and then Merle Haggard doing their thing. And I don't want to make other musicians angry, like we're part of the Bakersfield sound, but if hadn't for those two, they would have been like the same, their counterparts in Fresno or Stockton or Sacramento. Everyone had its own little circle of guys doing good, maybe getting on their local TV shows and maybe having a hit or helping write a song somewhere that did something. But that's pretty much the end of it, generally.
Mm-hmm. So, let's see. The radio and the television played a big role in the development of West Coast country music.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, what was your experience with television and radio? I know you mentioned that you were on a local TV show in Fresno when you were...
Yeah, well, that was live. And sadly, I don't have a single copy of that, you know, what it looked like. I'm sure I'd probably cringe if I saw it, but it was on the vein of, you know, what they did on a lot of the country shows at the time were doing, you know, Taylor Wagner Show and I'm blanking here, but you know, lots of people had, you know, His Girl Singer being Dolly Parton.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of those little country shows at the time. The Ranch Show and Hee Haw, of course, were a huge step up. And
that was a national
show. Yeah. Yeah. And the Ranch Show was done in a very assembly line process. We pre-recorded all the music for both those shows in our studio. So we went back there and it was just a rigorous one song after another, da da da. Just since we're just doing the song, the lyrics live, you know, we were doing a song every 6 or 8 months. We'd spend 3 days and do 13 shows for the Ranch Show. And it was just a lot of work. It was no fun.
Mm-hmm. What about Hee Haw?
Hee Haw spent a little more time, but it was the same thing. One afternoon, we'd do all 13 picking and grinnings. And then that morning, we'd do all 13 openings and closings mm-hmm. of the shows. And then for cast songs, we'd spend a day and do 13 cast songs with Buck. On another day, when we weren't there, they were doing 13 cast songs with Roy. And then we'd spend a couple of days doing just Buck Owens songs. And so when they had all the pieces they needed from us to edit the show together, they'd say goodbye and we'd go home. But in my first years there, my first twice-year tapings, so it was my first three or four tapings, the Buckaroos were the house band. Meaning, if so-and-so came on and didn't have their own band with them because the scheduling reasons, or they didn't have their own band, they were just a solo act, or whatever, the Buckaroos would back them, and we'd go in there and play live. So, I mean, the good news is I got to back everybody from, I backed Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, got to meet him, and Dennis Weaver, just actors, and just I met and hung out with the most fun, exciting stars ever. I loved it, but that made us have to stay there for the entire 5 week tape. Many times, just sitting around a motel room on call mm-hmm. on a rainy Nashville day, in Nashville, always in Nashville, just sitting around a hotel room. So during this period of time, of course, Buck would go home, he'd be done. And he couldn't do any recording or anything because we were stuck. So he renegotiated his Hee Haw deal on his next contract, saying the Buckaroos would be only backing him and his ex, and then we would go home. Mm-hmm. And they put together the Hee Haw band, which was Charlie McCoy and all those guys. And the good news is we got paid exactly the same amount. We got paid by the show. And we're out of there in 10 days instead of 5 weeks. And did all our stuff and left. And so we did that twice a year for 17 years. So it was like a second home to me.
That show brought a lot of fame to people that, I don't know if, you had mentioned earlier, like the Hager twins and Susan yeah. Ray and other singers that in that period were, you know, cutting their own albums. And,
mm-hmm.
and did Buck bring them to fame? Or
Well, Buck brought them to Hee Haw.
Mm-hmm.
Buck brought Lulu to Hee Haw.
Oh, yeah.
They made a joke about we wanted a big fat, funny gal or something like that. You know, but he said, well, I know a gal that's cool. And he introduced him and brought her on. He brought several people on. I actually brought a guy named Grady Humplack, Grady McNutt or something like that. He was a preacher who told funny stories. Mm-hmm. I met him on an airplane and said, you need to get in touch with Sam Lavallo, our producer. And, you know, but we would, there were many people who their entire career was based on Hee-Haw, all those comics, you know, Archie Campbell and those guys had a regional career, you know, playing at various music festivals and stuff around the, but String Bean and stuff like that, but they didn't really make it until Hee-Haw.
Well, you know, Grandpa Jones was a great banjo player, right?
Absolutely, and did he sell a lot of records and make a lot of money? No, but, you know, the strength of Hee-Haw really opened things up for him.
Mm-hmm. And then the relationship between Roy Clark and Buck, was that a good relationship?
Well, it was fine, but yeah. There was not a lot of overlap. If you think about it, what I explained to you, the way we taped, there was virtually one day of overlap at a taping where Buck and Roy did picking and greening, mm-hmm. openings and closings, and it's about it.
Really?
Yeah. It's about it. If you think about it, you never hardly ever saw them together at the screen at the same time. So then they had a couple of fights that were documented in Roy's and Buck's books where I was a witness to, where and I will take the sides on that. There was two different versions of it, but Roy at that time was very unprofessional and irresponsible. I'm sorry, but everybody on the cast knew it. He was he'd show up late for takings and make everybody wait, sit around and wait, and he had some issues at the time, and we usually did that overlap day on our last day of taping, because what it was our last day of taping and Roy's first day of taping, mm-hmm. where we'd go jump on the plane, go home, and he'd do all his stuff with the cast. We had airplane reservations, and dang it, we'd been gone for a long time, and we wanted to go home and play with him, you know, the baby's mama, mm-hmm. and we're ready to go, and doggone it, we had to get done, and if we got on schedule, we could get done by 3 o'clock, and the flight was at 6, and we could make it, and Roy Clark's no place to be seen. Mm-hmm. And so there was a couple of little incidents on that, where Buck asked anybody, the producer and everybody down, and I said, Buck was the consummate professional his entire life. Get there, do the job, get the job done. And in general, they got along fine. They got along fine. I think Buck had something to do with Roy getting his job, too. I really do. Now, I have to look in his book. I recollect that he brought him in. But terrific talent. Roy Clark would have had a career without Hee-Haw. He didn't seem to have a record career. He was kind of like a Wayne Newton. Huge in the live shows, but just couldn't seem to get a big record. And I think he's only had a couple of big hit records.
You know, just to follow up on that, drugs in the 70s were a big problem, and I'm wondering if that affected the Hee-Haw show at all, or was there any issues with drugs and alcohol and things like that?
I'm telling you, there were, but they worked around it.
Did they?
I don't know if anybody ever been fired from there because of it, but yeah, during the time there was, you know, during the time when cocaine was a big deal, I witnessed some real inefficiencies in our schedule.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And the Buck Owens faction, we were all pretty much straight arrows for various reasons, and didn't get involved in that. Knock on wood, thank goodness. But some of the people that were on that show were a mess. A few of them, not very many.
Mm-hmm. You've described working with Buck Owens a little bit, but if you can talk more about him and what made him so successful, what do you think the qualities that made him such a iconic figure in country music, and also an incredibly successful businessman. There's a lot of. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I would. He'd be the first to say when someone asked him, you know, mention how lucky he'd been, you know, in the business. He said, "Yep, that's right." He says, "The harder I worked, the luckier I got." Mm-hmm. And I would profess that going back to that era, you know, you can't, you know. Everything he did worked well in that era. If he took it all away from him and had him start all over again, he would have done it again, because he did it surely from Hardwork. He and I identified with each other possibly a little bit because he's the first guy to say he was a stylist. He wasn't the best singer ever. He had a great high tenor voice, but a lot of other singers, and he said he would have thought would have been better. Wasn't the best songwriter in the world, but he understood what people wanted to do. He kept it simple and understood. He knew things like, if I play this song nice and easy and make it easy to play, it'll be, the guys will be playing it in the clubs in a couple of days after they hear on the radio. And like, you know, I know the fans, of course, but there's no use throwing in every song. And so he knew what he was doing. He knew what sounded good on radio. Had a love for radio, and obviously ended up buying a lot of stations and starting an empire. But we'd go to a town, and it's exhausting to travel. We traveled flying commercial, and before that, he drove around in the camper. And you'd like to go to the hotel and sleep, you know, and catch up on your sleep. But, you know, first thing in the morning, he'd go up and visit the local morning show and meet the disc jockeys and hobnob with them and buy the show. And every shift, if he could, he'd pop over there and he'd see those disc jockeys. And then when he left, he'd write them a handwritten postcard and he'd keep in touch with them. Handwritten notes. And he worked hours and hours and hours a day and never stopped. Very disappointed with his other acts that he signed later that they didn't work as hard as he did. He just didn't understand it, why they didn't. But he made it happen. And that's why he was a great businessman. Attention to detail.
Mm-hmm. So he attention to detail, strong work ethic, and sort of a
drive.
And song selections that were more sort of simpler to play by the musicians. How was he to work with as just a
interesting. I mean, he could terrorize you and be really hard on you, and he could be the greatest. And this all came from his quest for perfection. And he expected the best in his people. And the positive side is that he brought out the best in you. And sometimes it wasn't easy, you know.
Right.
But you know, he always apologized later on if he was unfair to you. Always apologized and made it right. And if somebody had only seen the downside, I can see how they could say, well, that guy's a real ass. But when you got to see the whole package, I would do it again in a heartbeat.
But why would they say he was an ass?
Because
he was
if he was being disappointed, somebody wasn't doing their job right, he had no patience.
I see. Yeah.
Okay. And he could blow up.
Mm-hmm.
But he had, you know, he expected everybody to be professional. He wanted everybody to do it like he would, and you'd be the first to go out and do the job first. It wasn't like he was just sitting back with his feet up on the desk telling, hey, go over there and do that.
Okay. Who were some of the other artists you worked with in addition to Buck? You've mentioned several already, but...
Well, worked with. I mean, we toured, we met tons of artists touring and playing with them. So, I mean, so I knew them but worked with. The Buckaroos backed at various times Bobby Bear, Johnny Lee, we backed Charlie Pride, just recently Daryl Worley, lots of people at the Palace, Brad Paisley, of course, did a lot of him on his way up. Just tons and tons of people.
Has the music changed? I know you mentioned Charlie Pride. You know, I often think of this, that like he was a black country singer. There's none now, and I don't know.
There's one. Doris Rucker.
Okay.
But yeah, it's pretty sketchy. It's pretty slim pickings out there. You're right, and where's the black female? I don't know. Well, hopefully we'll see this change.
Have you found that the music's changed a lot in your in the time.
Oh, it's gone through several cycles,
mm-hmm.
and right now I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is.
And why do you hate it?
Oh, it's not country.
Right.
But it's bad 80s rock. But I get it. It's just the way it goes. And younger demo comes in, you know, the people are shooting for, and it evolves, and it gets really, really bad and not country, and then somebody comes out wearing a white hat like Alan Jackson did, while you know, hey, come and say, hey, there you go, that's country, and they revive it. So we go through these cycles, and I can't watch the award shows anymore. To me, it's you know, pyrotechnics, it's made for short attention spans, there's nothing country about it, but I'm not upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care what I think about it. I'm 68 years old and I'm out there buying the product or downloading it or streaming it or whatever. I mean, I'm not the guy they need.
Uh-huh.
You know, they need the 19-year-old girl, the 22-year-old boy, and they need, you know, they need to do whatever they need to go after them. Whether they're doing that correctly or not, I don't know. But that's what they have to be trying to do, and they need to leave me aside, and I can find my music elsewhere, not in prime time. But I'm hoping we'll see another renaissance of real country music.
I guess, speaking of a person that sort of followed in Buck's footsteps to try to revive, was Dwight Yoakam.
Mm-hmm.
Or did you know him pretty well, and can
yeah.
you talk about him?
Sure. Well, when he bobbed up and we first saw him in Los Angeles, and we were just an interesting phenomenon. But then, you know, we started hearing that he's carrying Buck's torch. It became more interesting to us. I remember getting a copy of Buck and I playing his cassette, guitars and Cadillacs, you know, in the recording studio control room, you know, and we were kind of aware of him. And then he was playing at the fairgrounds and came up and came in and met Buck. And Buck went out on stage and sang with him that night. Got up on stage, and he was the guy that brought Buck back.
Mm-hmm.
Although other guys were saying, you know, where's Buck? Keith Whitley did a song, let's bring back Buck. They were talking about Buck literally and also figuratively. Let's, you know, let's bring back the real country music. And Dwight was very instrumental in that.
You talked about Merle Haggard before too. What was the relationship with you guys?
Merle, you know, I engineered a few of his recordings in the recording studio. He used to work in our studio, and I'm an acquaintance of, worked with him 8 or 10 times. He's a hard person to be a friend to, I believe, and I wouldn't consider myself a friend. I was always sort of Buck's boy. So the relationship is tricky and interesting. Sometimes I had to be the bearer of bad news or the messenger. But
what do you mean?
Oh, I don't know. One time it comes to mind, after he was, I was engineering a session, and he'd been in the studio all night long, and when daylight was coming up, they decided to go ahead and pull a bus up front and just go ahead and party, and I quote-unquote kicked him out of the studio and said, sorry, we're going to have to pull a plug. And
no.
So anyway, there's much conjecture. You mentioned Buck and Roy Clark, but you know the thing about Buck and Merle's talked about, there's always been huge mutual respect between the two. Did they butt heads? Possibly. There was something between them and there, but just because they were both so competitive, they came out of the same thing. There was a competitive thing. It's like two guys, you know, that they could be golfers or whatever, you know, that, you know, you've got something going on there, that there's an undercurrent there that sometimes is there's the friendly thing and the thing that's a little more But Buck professed several times to me, and I passed it on to Merle after Buck passed away, when I had an opportunity once to say that Buck said, truly said, that he thought Merle was the best singer, the country, the best singer-songwriter that ever lived. He didn't say country. In a combination of voice and songwriter, he was the best ever. And what did I say? He was jealous? I don't know. I think Merle, being that guy, had to be, you know, that left brain, right brain thing people talk about. Buck got to have it both. I don't know if Merle could have been the genius he is and been a terrific businessman. I just don't know if people could ever be wired that way.
Well, Buck was that way, though, wasn't he?
But he wasn't the genius songwriter, singer, musician guy. He was a guy that was analytical and figured it out. Merle just does it.
And when you said he's hard to be friends with, what do you mean by that?
He might be great to be friends. He might be very easy to be friends with. I didn't find it easy to be friends with him. That just could have been me and like I say, the situation. One incident happened. There was a thing where Buck and Merle and Dwight played at the fairgrounds, and sometime, when was that? Early 90s or late 80s? They did a thing at the fairgrounds where we all played together. Merle did his video of Bill Can Hill. And that afternoon, as we were setting up, Merle comes driving up in a big Hummer, his MV. Mm-hmm. Came walking up to Buck and I, just standing on the lawn, and just the three of us there, and we were just chatting, and Buck said, you know, he hadn't said anything to me. So Buck says, well, you know Jim, don't you? And he says, oh yeah, of course. And then he turned back to Buck and said, you know the problem with piano players? Buck said, kind of had this quizzical look on his face, well, what's that? And pardon my language here.
I'm sorry.
He says, the left hand fucks up everything. And Buck kind of just, you know, jerked. Okay. And I just kind of laughed and smiled. A few more pleasantries, and off we walked. And Buck looked at me and says, "What is that all about?" And I've never played piano with Merle. So and I said, "You know, I don't really know, but I think it has something to do with, you know, I mentioned a couple times when I've had to." You know, business, I was on the other end of a business deal with us and I know his piano player, Mark Yeary, had a very strong, wild, crazy left hand, and maybe he got irritated at it a few times. I don't know, but that kind of sums up my relationship with Merle or whatever, but I admire him as a, he is a, he and Buck have just, he and his, him and the Buckaroos and the Strangers are polarized. We're so different. I got myself in a huge trouble one time. There was a local guy named Herb Benham.
He was a columnist for
the... Yes, for the California. And he was doing an interview with me many years ago.
With
me.
Or with you.
And we were talking about what we were doing, I don't know, but it was an interview that was going to be in his column, or in the paper. And I've never trusted journalists, and this is another reason why I don't. Kurt, Dad, so far, I'm not worried about this one because this was making tapes here.
Right.
I'm not paying you this brush, but I'm just saying that, you know, shame on me for that I wasn't careful enough. And we did an interview, and then we sat and chatted for an hour out in front of this coffee shop downtown or something. And we were talking about Buck and Merle and how different they were, and the Buckaroos and the Strangers. And he said, "Well, the band's different." And he said, "Because Buck hired me because I was a dependable guy. I could, I was going to show up for the airplane, I was going to show up for the recording studio, I was going to never mess up and be drunk, taking drugs, I was just going to do the job. 10 miles, well, I was okay, and I knew enough that he could teach me to play the music he needed on his records, because it wasn't jazz. It wasn't classical. It was straight ahead. Merle hires the very best guitar player, the best guitar player. End of story. And then And another time during the conversation, I'd say, well, the Buckaroos were like insurance salesmen. You know, we wore suits and ties and, you know, showed up. We live in suburbia with swimming pools, and I said, you know, we look like insurance salesmen. And then later on in the conversation, he said, so do all the strength, do they all move up north? And I said, oh, no, some of them still live in Bakersfield. Don Marks, for example, lives in the same mobile home park out there off of State Street. He's been in for 20-some years. And just commute. Okay. All that information gathered together. The article comes out, and he puts, Jim Shaw said, in quotes, the Buckaroos all live in suburbia with swimming pools, and the strangers all live in trailers.
Oh, man.
Well, I saw this in the paper, and I'm, eek, you know, these guys are my friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know these guys. So I called up, I said, you know, Jim, we know how writers are. We know you never would have said that. Anyway. so, anyway.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that makes you gun-shy.
That's why when Buck was doing an interview with you, the guy said, you mind if I tape this? Buck was like, well, actually, I pretty much insist on it. And he said, and by the way, I'm starting my tape recorder now at the same time.
Oh, really? So he was very careful about protecting...
Well, I could go back and say, I never said that.
Yeah. Yeah. Did he ever have any...
He never had to use that because I think it made people stop and think.
I see. Yeah. Do you think the lifestyle of country musicians has changed in the past few years?
Well, I think in the old days, you know, rock stars, you know, had their self-indulgent, crazy lifestyles. Mm-hmm. Country people were more grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that time, the country market was not even 10% of the pop market. There was not a lot of money in it. Nashville was different. Nashville was friendly. It was people that loved music. And Nashville always wanted country music to be like pop. We want the record sales. We want the gold. We want the million sellers. And Buck always said, careful what you wish for. Because right now, the big money people aren't interested in country music because there's not enough in it for them. And we don't, you know, right now it's people that love country music. And sure enough, when country music got bigger, all the attorneys and accountants from New York moved to Nashville and the managers. And started showing them how the pop people do it to get the numbers, and they got the numbers. But then they wrecked it pretty soon. They started picking the songs, and the artists started getting into that lifestyle we're talking about. Too many buses and semis. They have a 2 or 3 year run. They spend all their money on production. You know, nothing's left over at the end. Buck didn't do that. Buck invested his money in radio stations and real estate. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yeah, the lifestyle.
Okay. What are the best and worst parts about your life as a country musician?
Well, I can't answer that question because I don't feel my life is a life of a country musician.
No.
It's just a life. And at this point in my life, I'm only playing at the 2 weekends a month with the Buckaroos at the Palace, and the rest of the time I'm taking care of, you know, record masters and publishing and stuff for Buck and things that break at the Palace and doing jingles and stuff and my own business and taking care of my own properties and things. So I've never felt that I had a life as a country musician. We were the insurance salesman and got on a plane and flew to the dates and flew home. We didn't have the road stories on the buses.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, at the end, when Buck went on the road, we were chartering jets. And it was awesome. I mean, you sleep in your own bed that night. So, you know, disappointingly enough, I can't tell any of those good old boy stories. Like, I've never, I don't own a pair of cowboy boots. I'm just not the right guy to talk to.
How did you get into the business end of this thing? How did you? How what's the story on that?
Very early on, when we do a recording session, Buck had his own studio, and we do all the overdubbing. All the other guys, everybody was anxious to get home. Hey, Chief, so we called Buck was Chief. Hey, Donald, hey, Chief, y'all done with us? Need us for anything else? No, I guess when I'm done, you guys can go. Bam, out the door. And I was single, didn't have a family to go to, and I was fascinated by recording. So just very early on, a month or two in, after I moved to Bakersfield, I'm in the Buckaroos, everybody leaves, and I say, Buck, would you mind? I promise you I won't bother anything. Can I just sit over here in the corner and watch how to do this? I think this whole thing's fascinating. See how you do that. Man, his eyes just lit up. And he got up out of his chair and he said, here, come here. And he pushed his big captain's chair and said, here, sit here. And he grabbed a little folding chair and pulled it up and sat next to me in the folding chair and said, here, let me show you. Here's what we're doing. He was so excited to share his excitement with somebody else. And so that became the norm. And so pretty soon, within, you know, a dozen or two recording sessions, he said, okay, let's, Don had stayed behind to put some harmony fiddle parts on. He says, okay, Gene, you know what I want, you know what it's supposed to sound like. I'm going to head over to my office later, and he said, put Don's fiddles on. I'd still be working with the engineer, but I'd make sure he's in tune the part, work out the parts, and do the quote-unquote production. So I, kind of eased into being a producer that way. So eventually got co-production credits, and he let me be a producer. And in the same way, I wanted to do stuff a lot of times at night, and so I started catching on. I learned how to be an engineer. And I just learned, how do I patch this up myself so I can just do some, get a mic out here and do some recording and put the tape on. And then about 72 or 3, he said, Jim, how'd you like to, Bob Morris was running a publishing company at the time, the old bass player, the guy that wrote Made in Japan and Buckaroo. Mm-hmm. He was leaving to go back home to Arkansas, and he'd been running Blue Buck, and Buck said, how'd you like to run, get into publishing? And I said, Buck, I know nothing. He says, well, I'm going to give you the hat to wear. And so anyway, I learned publishing, and that became the deal. I just started getting hats, and that was the joke. When I bought a TV station, Jim, okay, I'll buy you a TV hat. And so Dale Kurtzinger was there longer than me. I became, when Don Rich passed away, I became the leader of the group. And someone said, well, why didn't Doyle do this? Or why didn't, Buck wasn't about seniority at all. He was about interest, mm-hmm. and passion. And just sadly, Doyle was at that point in his life, or the other guys, they didn't have a passion for it. They just wanted to do the job and go home. So timing was lucky for me.
So Buck Owens Industries, he has a lot of different kind of diverse businesses.
He did. Yeah, when he picked out, it was pretty big.
Like what did he have altogether? I mean, what kind of things besides the radio stations? He had
four stations in Phoenix, uh-huh. the ones that he sold for a tremendous amount of money in the mid-90s. And then the stations here, he had a TV station, KZZ TV 45. He owned his own publishing companies. Were mm-hmm. his number one country publisher in the world in the 70s.
Music
publishing. Uh-huh. He owned the rights to the songs. He owned songs and many other songs, including many of Mel's. He owned. This was a monstrous thing. He owned his own masters. He got his masters back. When you, the master of Together Again, or Crying Time, or Act, actually, he owns that record. Merle doesn't own his own. It's owned by Capitol Records. Mm. Buck negotiated him back and got him back. And that's huge. And Buck, magazines, Kurt Sharper, and eventually the Home Preview, and the camera ads, and real estate, a lot of real estate all over the place. The Crystal Palace. Back in the old days, he had his own travel agency. He had his own travel agency, his own graphic art department, ad agency. He did everything himself.
Amazing.
Booking agency. He had a huge booking agency. OMAC Artists, which means Owens McFadden, did all the booking on Yeehaw. All the acts were booked through his booking agency.
Well, Jim, you've answered a lot of my questions. Can you think of anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to talk about at all?
I could probably go day and night, you know, if
it's fine.
I'd like to mention that you know, people talk about Buck and his legacy and how he wants to work for that, you know, and the businesses around, in our businesses that still go on 8 years after his death. But I mean, there's a ton of people in this building that were within many decades. Mm-hmm. And that says a lot for Buck.
Yeah, he influenced a lot of musicians and artists, didn't he? And not only influenced them, but actually gave them their start in music. I mean,
well, later on, he influenced them in more of a, and not literally, making a connection or anything like that. But he fired them up and gave them good advice. And I've witnessed many of the talks he had with Trace Atkins or Garth Brooks. Garth Brooks got his record masters back through Buck's advice. Unbelievable. He owns his own masters because of Buck. And that's why Garth came to his funeral. I mean, he owed him a huge debt, and he knew it. But, Buck tried to talk to him about not letting, you know, the record labels and the publishing companies and big business take advantage of him.
He had a reputation for really caring about his fans to some extent, I guess.
Yep, he had fan clubs everywhere, yeah.
What about the day he died? I guess he was actually showing, he had shown someone the Crystal Palace before it was open?
No, actually the story was that he was feeling sick that night, he wasn't feeling good. Yeah, which, you know, it's the night he passed away. Mm-hmm. He told me, Jim, you're going to have to do it without me tonight, grabbed his bag. He told me as we were getting ready to go on stage. So I headed up on stage, and he headed out the door to his car. And around the corner came a couple. I said, "Oh, Mr. Owen, I'm so excited to see you. We've come all the way from Oregon. The last time we came through here, you weren't playing, you were sick. So we made another trip from Medford or whatever it was, and we're so excited to see you tonight." And Buck didn't have the heart to tell him he was just leaving again.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, and the reason, how would I know this story, right? Because the next thing I know, I'm on stage, mm-hmm. I'm on stage, and I turn around and I see Buck walking up on stage. And I said, I thought you were leaving. So he smiles, he gets up there, he gets his guitar, and he starts doing the show. Okay, cool. He's feeling better. Mm-hmm. Well, he told the story. He said, "These two people," he pointed over to the railing over, "these two people," said, "these two people, I met them there from Oregon, and I was leaving tonight. They were going to announce that I wasn't going to be here tonight, but they told me, and so anyway, they made a big deal about it." So that's why I know the story. And so about an hour later, had Terry sing a song, and he put his guitar around and came over to me, and put me on the show and said, "Hey, Jim, I'm heading on out." And I said, "Oh, well, good night, Chief." And that's the song. So, I always thought that, I don't know if Buck was a humanitarian in the big sense, but he was wonderful to people in the person sense. You know, I said, "We need to do this for people." "Oh, I don't care about them." But if they saw a person there and he wanted to talk to him or do something like that, he couldn't do enough for him. When they had a face and a name, he couldn't do enough.
That's something. I think that's about it, Jim. Are there some other people you would recommend I talk to for this project on the Bakersfield Sound? And it doesn't have to be the early people. Anyone who's been involved in the music industry here.
Yeah. Or even out of town?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could get a snippet of, if you're interested, Lee Fur was the engineer during...
How do you spell that?
Lee Fur, L-E-E-F-U-R-R.
Okay.
Was the engineer at the studio together for him, was there for about a two-year period.
Mm-hmm.
He could tell you maybe a few anecdotes. I can give you, I'll get you his information. Doyle has lost his hearing, and I just don't. It does be very. Might be difficult for him to talk, but Doyle Kurtzinger, the bass player.
Mm-hmm.
So sad. How many of them are gone?
Yeah, that's why we're doing this project, because we want to try to get as much as we can mm-hmm. documented before everybody's passed on.
I could try to get you Buddy's connection, Buddy Owens.
Uh-huh.
Let me see what else I can come up with.
Did he have any other children, or just Buddy? Or
no, no, he had Buddy and Mike were with Bonnie Owens, his first wife, and then with Phyllis he had Johnny.
Are they around here?
Johnny is, and Mike and Buddy both live in Phoenix.
Okay.
I'm not sure what Johnny would remember. You know, he was quite a bit younger.
Uh-huh.
But he might. I could be happy to give his phone number.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess that'll do it. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Yeah.